And this afternoon she's going to speak to us, give us a lecture on the title Debatable Devotion, Chandravati's Ramayana. So we're very pleased indeed to welcome her here this afternoon.
Thank you, Gavin. It's very kind of you to introduce me in such a way. I hope I can create interest in you in this very interesting Ramayana written by Chandravati in the 16th century. Chandravati's Ramayana is one of the many Ramakathas that have circulated in India and its contiguous lands through the past two millennia. While it follows the conventional plotline of Rama's legend, that is, his disinheritance and exile, Sita's abduction by Ravana, her rescue by Rama, her subsequent banishment on suspicion of her chastity, and her self-chosen death, Chandravati's poem is not a paean to Rama either as man or God. Unlike her great predecessors, Krittivasa and Tulasidasa, Chandravati, a late 16th century woman writer from eastern Bengal, makes Sita's suffering her subject and portrays Rama as a man only too fallible in his pride and jealousy and rash in his judgment and tyrannical in his action. Surprisingly, in the context of Bengali literary history, the poem thus stands out as a statement against the dominant literary ethos of medieval Bengal founded on bhakti, whether of the Vaishnava, Shakta or Shaiva persuasion. Chandravati's Ramayana originated in the Mymansingh region of Bangladesh, and it is from there that the text has been compiled over time. Firmly entrenched in the rural public culture of eastern Bengal from the time of its composition, Chandravati's Uvar, comprising this and two other narrative poems, survived principally in the oral tradition of singers and storytellers, backed by manuscript fragments in their private collections. It became available in print only in the 1920s, perhaps in the 30s, as a result of research efforts by antiquarians and folklorists of Bengal to gather manuscripts from rural caches. The first published version of the Ramayana appeared as a mere fragment in Dinesh Chandra Sen's collection Purvabanga Gitika, or Eastern Ballads of Bengal, and later in an enlarged collection of folk ballads from Moymansingha under the title Moymansingha Gitika, edited by Sukhamoy Mukhopadhyay. In the early 70s, Kritish Chandra Moulik brought out a much enlarged edition in his collection of verse tales from Eastern Bengal. A partial manuscript is held in Calcutta University's Bengali manuscript collection. Consisting of less than 700 rhymed couplets in three sections, this appears in Kritish Moulik's edition. The earlier edition had around 450 verses, which was collected by Dinesh Sen. So consisting of less than 700 rhymed couplets in three sections, one of which is entirely in Sita's own voice, the poem is by no means an overt complaint against Rama, but attributes Sita's suffering to destiny, which is, however, placed in parallel to the common fate of womankind in general, ordained by Vidhata, the god of fate. But the iteration of patient resignation is in itself an accusatory gesture, as it locks Sita's destiny to Rama's passion-filled jealousy. Further, the poem includes not the least hint that such a destiny is anything but eternal, or that it is merely an illusion of present suffering that will be reversed sometime in the future. Thus, the poem undercuts the ideology of bhakti by denying any conceivable hope for a blissful union with the divine being in whose service the devotee bears suffering willingly. Often, the devotee's compliance with his or her suffering is made palatable by the revelation that there is actually no suffering, that it is a mere illusion. This stratagem has been particularly popular with narrators of the Rama legend in grappling with Rama's treatment of Sita. It has been seen as so unbearably harsh that constant attempts have been made to explain it away either as a matter of necessary sacrifice or divine maya, as we find in Bhavavati's Uttarcharita. Later in Tulasidas's invention of a shadow Sita, like in Bhavavati, in Lanka Kando falls into the second group, which absolves Rama of the charge of injustice and which Tulasidas reuses in the Lavakusha Kanda later, again to reassure readers that the real Sita has been safely sent to heaven by Rama and it is only her illusory form that is now banished by Rama. Incidentally, how this illusory body of Sita gives birth to Lava and Kusha remains unexplained, or why they are reported to be already born in the preceding Uttarakhanda. Anyway, this escape route is not taken by Chandravati. She offers no apology for Rama's heartless act, but does explain it by tracing it to uncontrollable jealousy into which he is led by his evil sister Kukuya. This woman at whose birth the sun god Surya hid his face. I'll just try to read it from the original, because there's quite a number of Bengalis here, right? So you'll be able to follow. I'll try to translate. I am not going to read all of it, but Ashmaler Surjo Thakur go muk lukailo. The sun god Surya hid his face. This woman, Kukuya, maneuvers Sita into drawing a picture of Ravana and places it on her breast when she falls asleep, so that when Rama is brought into the room, he finds his wife holding Ravana to her breast as she sleeps. His rage knows no bounds. Rakto jaba akhi ramer go shire rakto uthe nashikai ognishash go brahmarandhru phute. Rama's eyes turn red and blood rushes to his head. His nostrils breathe fire and the crown of his head feels like bursting. This fire that Kukuya lights, Chandravati tells us, will consume not just Sita but Rama as well, and with him all of Ayodhya, Rama's perfect kingdom. Everything will be destroyed. Do not rise, sun, says Chandravati. Hide your face in clouds. O god of winds in the sky, blow no longer, for how may you bear the pain of one so free of guilt? Now it go tapon tumi meghe lukao mukh janamadukhini sitar tumi na dekhiyo dukh akasher pabon dev go tumi na bohiyo ar kemoni shohiba pabon go emon nirdushir dukkho bhar. Summing up with the aphorism that to trust to another's counsel is to bring ruin upon oneself, Chandravati delivers her judgment. O Rama, you have lost your mind. Chandravati kahe Ram go, tumar buddhi hoilo nash. Chandravati repeats this judgment in the poem's penultimate verse. Look what you have done, Rama. By listening to the counsel of wicked people, you have lost Sita forever. But amazingly, that is the extent of assigning guilt to Rama. Through the repeated lament over Sita's tragic life, both she and the poet trace her suffering solely to fate. She prefaces the overview of her life for her companions in part two with the lament. কি কইব কাহিনী বিধাতা সৃজিল মোরে গো জনম দুঃখিনী। What shall I say about my fate? What story narrate? Created a sufferer from birth by the Lord of Fate? This becomes the refrain of her recapitulation with its attendant fatalism. On being banished, she says to Lakshmana, None is to blame. It is my fate that has come full circle. And again I shall bear Vidhata's rule with bowed head. বিধাতার বিধান আমি গো মাথা পাইতা নিব। আমার লাইজ্ঞা সোনার লঙ্কা হইল ছাড় খার, আমি তো শুনিয়াছি লক্ষ লক্ষ নারীর হাহাকার। সেই অভিশাপ লক্ষণ গো আমার সুখ খাইল, কারো দোষ নাই গো আমার ভাগ্য সে ফলিল। ইট ইস ওনলি মাই ফেট। অ্যাট দ্য এন্ড সীতা অ্যান্ড হার ক্রনিকলার কাম টুগেদার ইন দেয়ার আন্ডারস্ট্যান্ডিং অফ দ্য ওয়ার্ল্ড। চন্দ্রাবতী কাঁদিয়া কহে গো কাহারো দোষ নাই, কর্মফল সুখ দুঃখ গো দাতা বিধাতা গোসাই। উইপিং চন্দ্রাবতী সেজ নান ইজ টু ব্লেম, কর্ম জয় অ্যান্ড পেইন আর গিফটস অফ ফেট। দিস ইনসিস্টেন্ট উইথহোল্ডিং অফ ব্লেম ইন দ্য ফেস অফ ক্লিয়ার কন্ডেমনেশন অফ রামাস আনজাস্ট জেলাসি সাজেস্টস এ রিসিডুয়াল অ্যাডহেরেন্স টু দ্য ট্র্যাডিশন অফ রেভারেন্স ফর রামা অ্যাজ গড। Coupled with the equally powerful tradition of devotionalism in eastern India, this double influence can be traced as much to Krittivasa's Ramayana as to the long-established spirit of devotionalism in Vaishnava poetry, especially in the poetry of Vidyapati, 14th century person, and to its most charismatic propagator, Sri Chaitanya Deva. Chandravati's poem does not belong to the Padavali tradition, but to the medieval Bengali tradition of folk narratives represented by gathas, palas, and githikas. But while it is cast as a popular tale, its content aligns it with the far larger world and the deeper ethical concerns of the epic tradition. We might bear in mind that Krittivasa's Ramayana is similarly composed in the form of a folk narrative. Despite its folkloric form, then Chandravati's poem promises to pursue the common view of Rama tale as the victory of good over evil brought about by Vishnu incarnate. This may explain why Chandravati refrains from explicitly accusing Rama. But on the other hand, she also refrains from conceding, as Krittivasa or Tulasidasa do, that as Vishnu, Rama is beyond human judgment. Her poem thus proceeds on two contradictory ideological lines. One moves along the apparent bhakti vector, where no open criticism of Rama is voiced, and Sita submits to his judgment without uttering any complaint against him, noticeably here in the contrast with Valmiki and Krittivasa's heroine, who chides Rama for acting like a low-born itara man, even as she declares her undying love and devotion to him. Chandravati Sita fits the common popular image of her as an infinitely submissive wife. This succeeds in drawing attention to her virtuous resignation, so insistently that placed against in Rama's tyranny shows in the darkest relief. As a result, we are never sure whether we are expected to adore or condemn Rama. In doing so, the poem at once accepts and denies its cultural context. Although it is situated at a distance from the exclusively bhakti texts of its time, it nonetheless shows complete awareness of the idea of the divinity of its principles. Like other Rama tales, this too calls Rama and his brothers a fourfold incarnation of Vishnu. I just will read a little from here. 1998. Okay. সর্বসুলক্ষণা কন্যা গো লক্ষ্মী স্বরূপিণী, মিথিলা নগর জুইরা গো উঠিল জয়ধ্বনি, হইল লক্ষ্মীর জন্ম মিথিলা ভবনে। এক চিত্তে পুণ্য কথা শুনো সর্বজন, জন্মিলা প্রভুর রাম নারায়ণ। এক অংশে নারায়ণ গো চাই রূপ ধরি, জন্ম লইলেন গো আইসা অযোধ্যা নগরী। সো হিয়ার রাম অ্যান্ড সীতা were identified with Lakshmi, still not entirely overtly, but still acknowledges, she acknowledges their connection with Vishnu and Lakshmi. The poem's link with Vaishnava rhetoric is evident in part 3, which offers an extended scene of the happy couple. Rama and Sita are not called Vishnu and Lakshmi, but they are so persistently compared to divine couples that it is hard not to see them as incarnations. We do not know how well-versed Chandravati was in Vaishnava poetry, but exactly the same kind of parallel between earthly and heavenly rulers is a common poetic strategy in Vidyapati's Padavali. In that poem, especially in the sections describing Radha's coming of age and the separation of Radha and Krishna, the imagined love connection between the divine lovers is reflected in the observed love between Vidyapati's patron, King Shivasingha, and his queen Lakshima or Lakshima. One might expect from Chandravati an attitude of self-erasing devotion, not only because she lived in an age of bhakti, but particularly because of what we know of her life from an account left by the poet Noyon Chand, written sometime in the 17th century. His poem tells of Chandravati's love for young Jayat Chandra, who deserts her on the eve of their wedding to marry a Muslim girl. To relieve Chandravati's grief, her father Dvijabanshi Das, himself the renowned author of Manasa Mangala, advises her to worship Shiva and to compose her own Ramayana. She turns away the remorseful Jayachandra when he returns to her, forbidding him, now a Muslim, to enter and pollute the temple where she worships Shiva. Heartbroken, Jayachandra throws himself into the river and drowns. While the authenticity of this account cannot be verified, its burden of betrayal and loss is close enough to the central perception of Chandravati's Ramayana to lend it some credibility. The overwhelming emphasis of the poem is on Sita's anguish, and that is how the poem has been understood by traditional folk performers. Both singers and scroll painters, I'll show you some scrolls at the end, they have till recent times sung it to rural audiences, sometimes underlining the pathos by meaning of showing patachitras or scrolls depicting Sita's sufferings. They still do it. They come to Calcutta, they sell these scrolls, and they say, if you ask them, they will, when they sell these scrolls, they will sing the story that they have depicted. It is also worth noting that the two other narrative poems attributed to Chandravati are both built on the theme of an innocent woman's betrayal at the hands of her putative protectors. The biographical parallel then may not be unsound. If we accept it, then we have an explanation of the ambiguity at the center of her Ramayana. On the one hand, as a Shiva bhakta, she's not likely to be a disbeliever, not reject the ideal of devotion. On the other, her experience cannot help but compel her to ponder the ruin of her life through no fault of hers. Chandravati's Ramayana thus hinges upon the theme of undeserved suffering. Setting aside the twin enterprises of war and honor in favor of focusing upon the life of the weak on earth, instead of glorifying battles, the poem mourns the victims. So complete is the concern for victims that the poem thrusts into the background even the ethical necessity that is understood in the major Ramayanas as the motive force of the story. That is the need to rid the world of Ravana. The demon king's defeat and slaying are briefly reported by Sita, who voices no delight, no relief at the destruction of her tormentor, lamenting on the contrary the devastation of his kingdom and the extinction of his line. The entire matter of punishing the evildoer is rapidly passed over in less than 10 lines, giving way to an idyllic section describing Sita's brief sojourn in Rama's palace, with which part 3 opens. But this episode, even as it unfolds, presages Sita's banishment, again through no fault of ours. The question that this narrative plan thus forces upon the reader is whether bhakti can survive in the face of unrelieved and undeserved suffering. Troubling enough on the social plane, in the spiritual context, the question can annihilate faith altogether when the perpetrator of injustice is God himself. This corrosive doubt is further sharpened by the gender issue in the poem. The principal victim of the male ego is, of course, Sita, first as the object of Ravana's lust and then Rama's proprietary demand. But there are other victims, including Mandodari and even Manthara and Kukuya, all of whom are driven by the need to obtain things that only a man can give them. Mandodari is driven to a suicide attempt by the indifference of Ravana, who spends all his time with other women. I must read a few lines from here.
Devakanna loiya go rani raja ashoko kanone keli kore rait din go horoshito mone ভুললাও তোমার কথা রানী না আসে অন্দর মহলে রানী তুমি রইছ কোন সুখে. And when Mandodari hears that Ravana is enjoying other women, she starts crying.
এই কথা শুনিল গো যবে মন্দোদরী রানী অভিমানে দরদ দরিয়া চক্ষে বহে পানি কৌটায় আছিল বিষ গো মুখে তুইল্লা দিল.
Mandodari is driven to a suicide attempt by the indifference of Ravana, who spends all his time with other women. More interestingly, Chandravati creates in her poem a veritable legend of bad women in the related stories of Manthara and Kukuya. Manthara is the evil attendant of Kaikeyi, and Kukuya is the evil daughter of Kaikeyi. This character is an addition by Chandravati. True, both are evil, motivated by malice and self-love. But what makes them evil? Manthara strives to ensure Kaikeyi's ascendancy, which led to Kukuya's birth and Rama's exile, are defensive moves against losing power within a royal household, entirely dependent upon one man's, King Dasharatha's, interests. Ultimately, these are consequences of women's total dependence on male patronage. Without male approval, women are nothing. That is what Mandodari comes to believe. Tragically, that is what Sita believes as well. Even though she is entirely secure in her conviction of her virtue, for she tells Rama, born to grief, I live only to gaze upon your face. A very different matter is the story of Kukuya, who is living proof that malice is not a male monopoly. But her plot too is a demonstration, albeit a negative one, of men determining women's lives. Is it not that urge to satisfy the male ego that in this instance corrupts female nature? If it were not for Rama's demand for both the reality and the appearance of Sita's sexual purity, would her life be doomed? Let us not forget that behind these principles of the story, there are those millions of women of Lanka who mourn their husbands and sons, whose loss has made them curse Sita because their lives are now worthless. Even deeper in the background lies Chandravati's own life laid waste by the betrayal of a man. Across the centuries and cultures, Jane Austen would have captured with immediate comprehension the fact of these women's dependency as their common condition. Set against this predetermined dependence of women, the usually highlighted materials of the Rama tale recede out of sight. The entire Rama-Ravana conflict at Lanka is squeezed into 15 lines of verse in part 2. The poem includes not one of Rama's many exploits, whether in battle or in providing succor to those in need of it. For instance, the forest dwelling rishis or Ahalya. Similarly, telling omissions are episodes of Rama meting out punishment to wrongdoers such as Shurpanakha and Valini. The poem ignores these assertions of Rama's Purushottama status, which bhakti ideology of Krittivasa and Tulasidasa celebrates despite their graphic violence and perverted justice. That is, Shurpanakha mocked, then mutilated, Valin slaughtered as an animal. There is a deliberate rejection in Chandravati's poem both of masculine heroism and of despotic rule. The whole concept of a just war is rendered meaningless by shifting the reader's gaze from those who wage war to those who suffer. Clearly, the focus is on process of Sita's inexorable doom rather than on Rama's heroism. With the poem so inescapably oriented to the experience of loss as the ultimate reality, it can hardly support bhakti as a viable spiritual idiom. This is not to see the poem as an assault on belief as such. Chandravati does not question the divinity of Rama, but his actions are another matter. They strain the doctrine that God loves humankind. That the grand design of creation eventually leads to bliss, even though the present may carry only pain. Chandravati accepts his all-powerful status, but neither the infallibility of his sense nor his sensibility, directly accusing him of allowing his passion to overmaster his judgment. That is the same lack of self-control that brought down Ravana. Is there not a parallel to him implicit in Rama's all-destructive self-love? Yet Chandravati does not romanticize opposition to Rama and his rabble as Michael Madhusudan Datta did 300 years later, for she chooses rather to leave her work ambiguous and thus capable of animating endless debate. Thank you. Now I will show you some visual presentation that continues to be shown in Calcutta, in and around Calcutta. And these Chitrakaras or the painters, they call themselves coming from Chitrakara Jati, that's a painter's caste. They do not call themselves neither Hindu nor Muslim. They are painter's caste. And every winter they come to Calcutta, that's how I met them. And they present mostly from the Ramayana stories and also some other, like Manasa Mangal is another very favorite of them. They also take up modern stories like Iraq War, they painted scrolls after scrolls with and while singing. So this is the first one I thought I'll show you. This one comes from Chandravati Ramayana, as far as I could say, see. From their or hear from their songs. This is the first Agni Pariksha or the fire ordeal after Sita was rescued from Ravana's Lanka. And here is Agni Deva, the fire god, is protecting her, and I don't know who's pouring water to calm down the fire. But beside Rama is Lakshmana, and perhaps also, I don't know who that is. Is that Vibhishana they are trying to show? But it is in Lanka that it is being shown. What's the next one? Shall I just go like this? This one talks about the Kukuya's story. Kukuya is the evil sister of Bharata, who was born when Manthara, Kaike's attendant, asked her to eat the mango
stone.
Mango stone, yeah, the stone. The stone, well, that the mango which was eaten by Kaushalya, Sumitra and Kaikeyi to conceive four brothers, the leftover stone was prepared for Kaikeyi, and she ate that, and the result was a very ugly looking, evil minded daughter, Kukuya, who was so jealous of everyone, she could not bear to see anybody happy. So she tried to ruin Rama and Sita's happiness when they got back. The story is like this. When once Sita, when she was 5 months pregnant, after they came back from Lanka in Ayodhya, she was requested or urged by Kukuya to paint Ravana's face, to which she said, I haven't seen him. I can't do it. No, you must do it. You must have seen it. So upon her insistence, what she did, she tried to remember when Ravana abducted her, her face she could see on the water, in the ocean. So from that memory, she drew these faces of Ravana. And the story goes that on a fan, she drew more faces of Ravana. She started with one, then three, then five, then went like that. And Kukuya, when she fell asleep after, you know, she dozed off in the afternoon, she was tired. Kukuya took that photo, the picture, painted picture, and put it on her breast, and then went to Rama and brought her in and showed him that, see, Sita has not forgotten Ravana. Looking at that, Rama was rakta javaki go brahmarandra puteshi. He was mad. He did not ask for any explanation. The next day, he sent Sita off to Valmiki's tapovana. And we know the rest of the story. When Sita was brought back, because Ayodhya was suffering from various illnesses and other sorts of disaster, it was not prospering at all. Then their priest suggested that he should do a yajna, a sacrifice. But to do a yajna, he needs his wife to be present. So Sita was asked to come back, but Rama again wanted her to, we know the story, wanted her to go through a fire ordeal. Sita says, I don't know, to satisfy you, I'll do it, but I just can't bear it anymore, any longer. And her mother, Vasundhara, we know the story, she, all of a sudden, when she was about to enter the fire, because Rama told her so, her mother appears, opens up the earth, and Sita disappears. At the last moment, Rama tries to grab her hair, but she disappears. So, but, you know, with a song, beautifully sung, I heard this. There are more to it. There are about usually 10 to 12 such paintings, scroll paintings, and with that.
What is this line that she...
Here, this is the opening of the earth.
Kind of tunnel.
Oh, I see.
This is Sita's Patal Pravesh. This is...
Sita was born out of an opening in the earth.
Yeah, that's why her mother is the earth.
So she's gone back in there. I see.
Her mother took her in. You don't have to. And actually, in that, in the poem, she comes and says in quite a few lines that you don't have to suffer any longer. You come to me. Let him suffer. That's what Vasundhara says. So I stopped here.
So and Rama comes out as morally ambiguous in this, doesn't he? He's,
And I hope I have given some idea of what it contains, and it's a fascinating story for me.
Especially, I feel as a woman author, Chandravati. I mean, all women, I should think, whenever you read Ramayana, the first thing strikes you are all this unfairness of Rama. And especially a woman feels it, I mean, everybody feels it, but as a woman writer, that she pointed out these facts so vividly.
Eloquently. Yeah, but mind you, she never ever so openly criticized Rama. Mm. She just said, it's nobody's fault. Is God of fate, Vidhata Gosai. Mm. So she gives him, she does not, it's not a protest, it's kind of statement about what a woman's life is.
You see, because
Mandodari, Sita, Mandodari, and her own life. Mm. She was betrothed to this Jayachandra. Mm. The very last day, the day she was going to get married, all of a sudden this man, there are many stories about him, he was... He married a Muslim girl, Kaji's daughter, and regretted that very night, came back, but he's already polluted, so she never took him back. Yes, Anuradha?
I was just wondering, does Chandravati make any reference to Valmiki's Ramayana? Because in some sense, you know, the Valmiki puts a context to how Ram treats Sita, because it opens, doesn't it, the Ramayana, with that idea of Valmiki. The question is raised, who's the ideal man? The question is, who's the ideal king? And so the whole narrative is spoken that this is, Ram is the ideal king, and he is ideal because he is prepared to give away that which is most dear to him. So the slant is on the man, or the ideal king. And Sita sort of fits into that whole context. So even though, yes, this emphasizes the injustice to the woman, Valmiki's purpose was to say that a king is so subject to his own subjects that he would be prepared to separate himself from his wife, as perfect as Sita. So just wondering, did Chandravati make any reference?
Chandravati did not make any such reference, but to answer that, you know, there is one question that I brought in that book of mine, Women in the Hindu Tradition. You know, Rama, yes, he fulfilled his Rajadharma, Purushottama.
Right.
What about his duty to his wife? That's also a duty.
Right.
He ignored that. Rajadharma he did as a Raja. But you look at Brihaspati, you look at Vashishtha, Baudhayan, they have said that no matter what is the situation, if your wife is abducted, if she is raped or anything, a man cannot reject his wife. And he knew Shastra. So Valmiki never addressed that. He just said, brought in front of us, that, you know, in so many adverse situations, true, I'm not denying that Rama suffered a lot. What about Sita? No, she did not gain anything. Rama gained something as a Raja. Everybody said he's a good Raja. What did she gain? Nothing. So it's a very controversial thing, and that bothered everybody, including writers on Nataka, writers on literature, everywhere. And in Bengal, we have come across, if I studying some Bengali Ramayanas, and also somebody like Ishwar Chandra Vidyasagar, what he did, he asked through Vasishtha's mouth, the final Vanavasa was done. And in Tulsidas, we have Chaya Sita, two Sitas.
Also, the Kurma Purana makes reference to the Chaya,
Chaya Sita. There are many instances of Chaya Sita. I think in my book I have mentioned that. And also Maya Sita. Mm. Mm. So they tried to avoid this. Mm. And in Ramananda Sagar's 1987 Ramayana, which everybody has watched, that's how the author and the film director handled that. Otherwise, how can we justify this kind of thing? And we do not know about Shambhuka, Balin, Shurpanakha. These are very troubling questions. So that's why, you can say Valmiki treated him as a human being, but Purushottam. Whereas from Krittivasa's time on, Talita, he became God. Valmiki did not make him God.
Not explicitly, indeed, but
like and that could be at the end, when he didn't know. Naham jane devatam, manushyam manne. That's what he says at the end. He knew himself as a dasharathatmacham, manushyam yaha, that's something like that. He said that I knew myself as a manushya.
That's right. But again, it depends on how you view the first and the sixth and seventh books, because it's explicit, the divinity of Ram. But it seems that Valmiki's purpose in the main narrative is to show an ideal man. King, not someone who's...
Yes, from second to sixth, it's a different world. Seventh could be Prakshipta.
The Valmiki Ramayana really is very strongly ideological. Of king supremacy over everybody, including the Brahmins, the husband's supremacy over the wife, and it's probably a Rajadharma kind of statement rather than a Dharma Shastra.
But still, can you justify that? Well, if you only do Rajadharma, you are really doing the right thing, but you have some duty to your wife as well.
But if duties collide,
then customs.
From the point of view of Rajadharma, the highest duty, you don't want to kill, but you'll kill people in war. You don't want to give up your wife, but you may have to do it. Krishna is doing it in the Mahabharata. The Mahabharata criticizes what's going on. The Ramayana doesn't raise much criticism. It's a purely ideological, patriarchal, Rajadharma kind of talking, right down to the husband.
That's true, and that's he also suffers at the end.
And it's not that different parts of India see it differently. Not just the Bengalis. You get interesting accounts in which he's mocked in some places,
particularly in the south.
Is that so? Well, they might in the south. The whole southern is about that.
What exactly does Purushottama mean? Why is Raja Purushottama? Is that the ideal of manhood? That's a crucial ideological question, I think. What is Valmiki's ideal of the male persona? Raja?
That I don't know, but I see the text itself as a statement of the highest duty of the duty of the state. Mm-hmm. For reasons of state, he has spies. It's an unpleasant aspect that we live in all the time.
In other words, this Purush, this idealized Purush, is in a very narrow context. Defined in a very narrow context of statehood.
Some people try to make him ideal by undermining the dominance of the Rajadharma state, ideological character of what seems to be Valmiki's text. There are different groups pulling up the Rama thing.
And somehow we haven't come across a Purushottama in a Brahmin caste, have we?
No.
In the entire literature, a Brahman is referred to as a Purushottam.
Can you remember?
I can't remember. Can you?
No.
It's connected with Raja.
Maybe because Brahmanas are regarded as being more than human.
Kings tend to sponsor these recitations, so it's better. And kings tend to look upon themselves as hiring Brahmins. Brahmins think of themselves as higher than kings, but that's when they gather among Brahmins and discuss these kings. In court, the kings are the boss. Unfortunately, it's immoral.
Yes, Herbert?
It's illogical.
I have a question that's kind of going big away from this topic. So. Is that okay?
Yeah, okay. If I can answer.
When I was listening to you talk, describing the story of Chandravati, of the way she kind of portrays the Ramayana, At several times I was struck at the parallels with the stories that become very popular in Bengal in sort of the I missed the beginning of your talk, so I don't know exactly when Chandravati lived.
In 16th century.
Okay, well, sort of around the same time of Krishna and the gopis, and particularly Radha, who kind of have this ambiguous relationship with Krishna too. And on one hand, you know, he's their lover, but he abandons them. He leaves Vrindavan. He goes to Mathura and later to Dwarka. And you know, and particularly Radha kind of gets this criticisms that they address to Krishna, that what kind of a person are you? You just leave us behind here, so to what extent do you think there's sort of an influence from that strand?
Okay, one thing that really strikes me, although Radha Krishna's story was very popular at that time, but it's mostly when Radha and Krishna was together. And remember, in Bengal, Shakta and Shaiva, both those influences were very strong. And her mother, Chandravati's not mother, father, was a Shaiva Bhakta. So she was asked to attend the Shaiva Mandir, and she was trained in that. So it was there, Radha Krishna, but as a, you know, couple, rather than Mathura Vrindavan story, which was more prominent in Dwaraka area, Mathura Vrindavan area. In Bengal, when we have come across the Mandir, Radha Krishna Mandir, and it's their love, their togetherness. And today you go to Mayapur, you see all those stories depicted, all those sakis. But we have...
But you have it in the Bhagavata, for example.
Yeah.
So that text is very popular.
Bhagavata Purana is very popular. But at the same time, other Puranas were popular, and Shaiva, Shakta. So, I don't know, she had more than one story to look into. And Ramayana is something that was going on from 14th century. We are, you know, acquainted with Kirtivas, who has changed it according to his bhakti mode. And there Lakshmi and Vishnu is focused again, and she accepts that. She has written in, you know, more than 10 verses that they are Lakshmi and Vishnu, Swarupini, rather than totally identify that this is Vishnu and Lakshmi. It is like Vishnu, like Lakshmi, that sort of thing.
Does Shiva at all come up in the story?
No. Her other story, which is another rejected woman's story, also does not deal with that. Maliwa Sundari. Yes?
It's a quick question. Does Chandravati talk at all about the Lakshman Rekha? You know that famous trope?
No.
Because I'm trying to find, where did that come from? It's popular in all the stories, and it's not in Tulsidas's Ramayana, nor is it in Valmiki's Ramayana.
I think it is in Kirtivas. I think it is in... I'll check it.
I checked as well. I didn't find it there.
It didn't...
And I was surprised. I expected to find it. Because it's
but in Bengal, we
everyone
come...
Everyone has it.
Yeah. We have... Recently, I bought some kind of antidote for cockroaches, which is called Lakshman Rekha. And you can put that Rekha, you know, white chalk powder. And really, cockroaches cannot go beyond that. So I bought it. Not that I have any cockroach, but it really fascinated me. Anyway, I'll try to look it up.
I mean, it's popular culture, but where did it first come from?
I'll definitely let you know. It comes to my mind. One person will definitely tell me is Robert Goldman. I'll just write to him and find out. Yes.
In your text, you mentioned that some writers, they blame or unable to solve this problem of the divine performing evil acts, or that they blame it on Hanuman's Maya. And this I've seen in the Bhagavad Purana also, the text that I'm studying, that when some sort of suffering is inexplicable, then they say, oh, we can't understand this, therefore it must be due to Maya. So I was just curious, in terms of this particular narrative that you're reading, is it just saying that it's inexplicable, or is it the same as destiny? Is it saying that
destiny?
It's
he's focusing on the word destiny so many times, but never uses the term Maya.
But other writers used it. You said something like that.
Yes, other writers, definitely. Everyone else, but he is focusing on Vidata. And it's a very sad story of Mandodari as well. When Mandodari learned about her husband's, you know, enjoyment with other women, abducting them, she starts crying. And what she did, when, according to this story, Ravana went and conquered heaven, on his way back, he asked the munis, the rishis, to donate some blood from their heart. So they, from the chest, they slit it and got some blood, and he collected in a pot those blood. And he came back and gave Mandodari. Mandodari said, gave that pot to Mandodari, and Mandodari said, what's in here? He said that in that pot I collected something with which I will kill all these immortal gods, because I have collected some very strong poison. And so faithfully, Mandodari puts it away. But when Mandodari hears about this Ravana's dilly-dallying with many women, she starts crying and thought, what's the use of my life? I'll try to commit suicide. So she drinks that poison. And in this story, she conceives. Instead of dying, she conceives and delivers an egg. And that egg, from that egg, Sita is born.
It's a strange story.
It's a strange story, but, you know. Well, that egg was, you know, she delivered an egg, and when the delivery, when after the delivery, the astrologers at Ravana's court said, your wife has delivered an egg, and from that egg, a girl child will be born who will be the reason for your ruin. So abandon that egg. And Mandodari starts crying, no, don't burn it or abandon it. That was a suggestion from the court. Let us just, you know, put it in a basket. And that's what they did. They put it in a basket, you know, covered basket, and let it be in the water, just like Moses, many stories, yeah, including Karna, Moses, mm-hmm, and all. Yeah. And that basket reached Janaka's shore. And one...
Did you go upstream?
Upstream?
No.
The fisherman
collected it, and when the fisherman took that basket and gave it to his wife, who had no children, she just put it in a kind of shrine, meditative shrine, and the egg was still there. Meanwhile, she dreamt that egg will produce a girl child who should be taken to Janaka and his wife. And that's what she did, and she asked Janaka's wife that, please name her after my name. Her name was Sata. So from Sata, she became Sita. Mm. It's a very interesting story once you read it. Very unusual story. And
Where is that?
Chandravati Ramayana. I haven't come across this story.
Doesn't Sita mean furrow? Did you change the meaning of the name?
Yeah.
And from the ground, Sita comes from the ground, and Sita literally means a furrow there.
Yeah, but this story says from Sata,
she
asked Janaka's wife, the queen, please, I don't want any reward, but remember her through my name. My name is Sata, name her Sita. I'll be happy with that.
Just one more question on this destiny. But how does that help? How does it help to blame it on destiny or on Bhagavan's Maya in let's say, in Chandravati's Ramayana? Because aren't destiny and Maya, aren't these things, you could say, aren't they under or they, if Ram is God, then it's still putting the blame on Ram. In the sense that, why do these authors use, in your view, why do they use destiny sort of as a crutch?
Destiny is different from Maya, because through Maya you have some, you know, in the future it will be gone, this is an illusion, everything will be fine, this is God's Maya and God's Leela. But destiny, it's just giving up. This is women's fate. Women are born to be sufferers, and there is no question there. Why? There is no why. She says karmaphal sukh dukkho, karmaphal sukh dukkha. These are vidhata's doing. Vidhata Gosai. Karo dosh nai. Nobody is to blame. Nobody. So she just gives up. Three women's story. One is Sita, one is Mandodari, one is her own story. But there is no blame. So unusual thing is that before her, nobody, no woman that we know of has ever voiced this kind of, you could call injustice, you could call, you know, fate, whatever. But nobody has voiced it. But she never protested why it has happened. I haven't done anything wrong.
There is a moral design behind that story of origin. It's because Ravana does an evil thing by taking the blood from the hermits, that there is that pot of overpowering blood, which Mandodari drinks because Ravana is evil. And because she drinks the blood, she produces the egg, and on and on and on. And the girl child really becomes the cause of Ravana's ruin. There is that moral design. Mm. It's a very powerful narrative, motive force.
Yes, Joe.
Yeah. There's another interesting fate story in Gaudi, probably late 16th, maybe 17th century, but the Alal half of Shruti Moina, Vajradhani Shruti Moina story, in which the second half, which I think is Alal, the king has his women about and says, aren't you all lucky that because of my fate, you have been born into my harem? And all the women except one nod and say, yes, you'll be fine, that your fate has brought us here. And the other one politely remains silent. And the king asks, why is she silent? She says, well, I think it may well be my fate that's brought me here. If you like that, he doesn't go into a rage, but he says, let's test it. Not much of a test. It's tilted a bit. He said, we'll put you into a box that will float with a certain amount of water and food, and we'll set you out at sea and see if your fate brings you back here. She says, all right, we'll have to do this. So she leaves the box, you know, float around, and she lands somewhere else, and almost gets into difficulties, but manages to escape those, and goes through one of these challenging things in the end, and really all the way to the end, but I believe she comes back triumphant and showing up. Her fate is actually rather good one. Mm. You presume that the husband
so,
is doing
so in the 16th, 17th century, this fate,
yeah.
Fate is
a Muslim writer, enough, but a Bengali Muslim. Mm.
In Purvabanga Gitika of Dinesh Sen, we have 19 of such kavyas, and we might come across more of this kind of living it up to the fate. Mm-hmm.
It also is a way of not saying that you're out and out atheist and the like, and then you're really in trouble, and the singer starts doing it, so then you're sort of undermining without directly challenging it.
What
you do, oppressive regimes.
It's interesting. I'll remind you
of the
right
writers we don't know of, that we're doing all of this, all the stories they were telling each other, and all of the ferment that was going on, that you just get bits and pieces of.
Well, we've gone 20 minutes over our allotted time, but thank you so much, Dr. Krenta, for a really interesting and stimulating talk. And it makes you want to go and read Chandravati, actually, doesn't it? Is there any English version of it?
No, that's what I plan to do.
You're doing it.
That's what I'm doing. Yes. You know, with this critique and also the translation. My daughter is helping me in putting it together. So this is, I just copied it from Dinashan's version, which has only 450. And this one has, this is mine, Titish Maulik.
text, the whole text, or there's
something? No. Only 700. There are many more. Only 700 lines.
What's the overall focus of Kitish's book?
Oh, just a collection of Purbabanga Gitika.
Not all feminist ones.
No. And I don't buy that Chandravati is a feminist.
No?
No. No, it's not, because it's not a protest.
You don't think so?
No, it's not. It's, where is it? It's not a protest one. It's a misreading of Chandravati's, according to me, it's not a feminist one. It's no protest. She's just giving up. She's not blaming anybody.
But she has set out so much evidence there that you don't have to blame. It takes courage.
No, but she is in when she speaks her mind, she does not say that it's a, this world, the patriarchal society. She never says that.
It would be dangerous to say that. She's intelligent, so she says it in another way and knows how far to go.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts.